Good evening and welcome back on this Saturday, the 23rd day of March. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and it was such a busy week, it's almost difficult to know where to start. Although if we don't get started quickly, the censorship that's increasingly evident on the web may shut us down, so maybe that's the place to go first. Let's do it initially by way of a bit of good news anyway, even though it hardly amounts to an umbrella and a hurricane. Late in the week, President Trump signed an executive order that allegedly promotes free speech, even on college campuses. Yeah, the Centers for Higher Indoctrination. What the executive order does is to try to tie federal research funding for colleges and universities to their policies governing free speech. Said Trump at the White House, "We're delivering a clear message to the professors and power structures trying to suppress young Americans and all Americans from challenging far-left ideology." Flanked by free speech advocates, he continued, "People who are confident in their beliefs cannot censor others. They welcome free, fair, and open debate, and that is what we are demanding." So basically, the claim is that federal agencies will now use their authority under various grant-making programs to ensure that public universities actually protect and cherish, yeah, sure, that'll be a change, won't it, the First Amendment and the rights of their students. Or, he says, they risk losing millions and millions of federal taxpayer dollars. Now, there are all kinds of issues, obviously, here, like how subjective will it be? Will future administrations go right back to doing what they're doing everywhere else? And that's more censorship? You know darn well all of that will happen. Maybe the best option here would be to say anything that anybody anywhere thinks looks like an impingement on free speech results in a cutoff of university funding. Which would mean that if everything eventually got cut off, we'd be back to the constitutional limits on such funding anyway, which is zero, if you actually read Article 1. Well, anyway, says the Free Beacon coverage, it remains unclear how the order will be enforced, if it'll be enforced, or which speech restrictions will result in termination of funding. But at least the president finally seems to have taken note of the fact, and maybe even taken a tiny bit of action, that censorship on every front you can imagine has literally run amok. So let's recap next some of the things that led up to this, i.e. Big Brother's public-private partners. I like the headline here from InfoWars. "I will be looking into this," says President Trump, as he warns Facebook about censoring his social media chief. Because if big tech can censor the White House social media director, you might think they can censor anyone. President Trump, says the story, responded to reports that to Facebook, correct spelling, temporarily censored his social media director, Dan Scavino Jr., warning, "I'll be looking into this," and asking, quote, "Dear Facebook, amazing. Why are you stopping me from replying to comments followers have left me on my own Facebook page? People have the right to know. Why are you silencing me? Please, LMK, thanks," wrote Scavino on Monday. And the man who has 300,000 followers included a screen grab showing that Facebook had marked his post as spam with the message, "You're temporarily blocked from making public comments on Facebook," prompting the president to fire back at both to Facebook and big tech, saying, "I will be looking into this." And I guess, folks, if that's what it takes, it's, well, more than about time. And this, of course, follows on the heels of California Representative Devin Nunes having announced his $250 million lawsuit against Twitter, as the first of many to come against big tech, for abuse and censorship and all kinds of other nasty things of politically incorrect conservatives. Said his personal attorney, "Twitter is a machine. It's a modern-day Tammany Hall. And Congressman Nunes intends to hold Twitter fully accountable for its abusive behavior and misconduct." But wait, there's more. This also, courtesy of Jim Hoft and the Gateway Pundit, confirmed, it says, President Trump has unwittingly busted Twitter in a massive ploy to mask and downgrade his popularity. They've just been caught manipulating the president's analytics. Just how, they asked, does the most popular person in the world get only 11,000 retweets? How does a person with 59 million followers get only a few thousand likes per post? Twitter is deceiving the public, says Hoft, and masking the president's popularity. After Nunes' bombshell versus Twitter for $250 million on Monday, that same evening, President Trump tweeted three videos that prove he is also being shadow banned. The first one, with Mark Levin around 6 p.m., had over 1 million views, but only 12,000 retweets. Impossible, writes Hoft. And then there was Tucker Carlson about 9 p.m. with 706,000 views at that point, only 11,000 retweets. Also, well, let's just say these kind of coincidences aren't that believable. And then finally, a Hannity video that he tweeted at about 11 p.m. Eastern time with 154,000 views and only 1,800 retweets. Yeah, right up there with so many terrorist attacks corresponding to pre-planned drills. So, concludes Hoft, we already know that Twitter is targeting pro-Trump Republican lawmakers like Matt Gaetz, Devin Nunes, Mark Meadows, Jim Jordan, and John Ratcliffe with their shadow banning techniques. They're also censoring prominent pro-Trump accounts. There's a whole long list of those. And many Twitter users have long suspected that the president, too, was being censored, and it looks like he just made the case. We'll follow that up with a couple of comments from Louisiana Attorney General Jeff Landry, who appeared on Breitbart News Daily with host Alex Marlowe, and noted that when it comes to censorship, quote, all options are on the table to break up the big tech monopolies. Both Democrats and Republicans, he said, are waking up to the fact that they need to consider all actions, including the use of existing antitrust law, to curb the growing power being held by high-tech firms such as Gulag to Facebook and Twitter. We've seen a tremendous amount of consolidation, he said, in regard to social platforms and the tech industry over the last decade, and the result of that has become a handful of companies that have amassed a tremendous amount of data and power over the U.S. and world economies. Just the fact that they can censor any type of speech is problematic, on top of the fact that the monetization of people's personal data is enriching these companies at the expense of the consumer. And he doesn't say it, but I can't help but think it. And perhaps even giving them blackmail power, kind of like DHS and the NSA have had for quite a while, not just over the peons at large, but over various deep state swamp critters, from members of Congress to, arguably, members of the U.S. Supreme Court. Landry went into quite a bit of detail on the ways that these socialist media giants not only manipulate with their political biases, but also noting how search engine users can be deceived by Google's advertising practices. Here's the money quote from that sequence. When you look at the amount of data, the amount of processing power that these companies have at their disposal, they know more about you than you know about yourself, said Landry. We've seen them make comments like, quote, we can basically bend the consumer in the direction we want him to go rather than what he wants. And that, said Landry, is not independence, that's not liberty, that's not a free market, unquote. And he noted that in a couple of weeks, in fact, he said, I think it's next week on the 25th, there's a roundtable being conducted by attorneys general in front of the FEC to discuss this, to discuss the harm that's placing on consumers and whether or not it will lead to antitrust action against these companies, or whether or not we should be looking more carefully on any mergers or consolidations or buyouts by these tech companies, unquote. At this point, we need to go back and connect some dots from earlier in the week when it comes to the latest really stench-filled false flag in yet another gun-free killing zone. And you no doubt already know where I'm headed. Memory Hole, New Zealand, says a piece from Eric Kessel at the Activist Post. And you no doubt know the latest official narrative. 28-year-old Brenton Tarrant murdered 50 people, injuring scores of others, at the time of this report, all by his lone gunman self. But, and how many times have we seen this, there are more questions than answers regarding the attack. For instance, New Zealand authorities reported after the incident that 4 suspects were taken into custody, 3 men and a woman, and they added that they had found and neutralized several IEDs. And that's improvised explosive devices, if you're not up on your Hollywood talk, on the vehicle stopped during the arrest. MSN even wrote that the IEDs were attached to the attacker's vehicle. That was cited by the Associated Press at the top of the article. And CNN reported that New Zealand Police Commissioner Mike Bush said in a press conference that the vehicles authorities had stopped did have those IEDs strapped to them. Quote, there were a number of IEDs attached to vehicles that we stopped, unquote, said Bush. Meaning, notes Kessel, that people arrested weren't just arrested for no reason, and they may have been involved, despite the mum press failing to ask the obvious important questions. And that, too, we're getting used to. Furthermore, and how many times have we seen this? You know, I've been saying that a lot when it comes to these kind of false flaggy looking gun-free killing zone mass murders, haven't I? Early reports by the mainstream press of the event suggests there were multiple shooters from witnesses and police. He quotes a couple of sources, including the Spectator first, saying that New Zealand police reported the possibility of three active shooters in those Christchurch mosque attacks, while Ryan Saavedra quoted the New Zealand Herald reporting that the shooting at the second mosque was stopped by an armed Muslim who chased shooters and fired two shots at them as they sped off, signifying one of two things, maybe more, that either this was a false flag attack, ding, 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 or that there were more than one persons involved in this horrific act, and that seems likely as well, and that the New Zealand government has elected, or was pressured, to declare the attack as the work of the stereotypical lone gunman. In any case, if the obvious, repetitively boring pattern is any guide, and it sure has been up until now, and this doesn't look like an exception, expect a cover-up. We've seen that taking place already, with information being memory-holed, as activist post-contributor Vin Armani has already tweeted, while he still can. Quote, four people were arrested after this NZ mosque massacre. Watch how the other three disappear into the memory hole. That's because they were almost certainly the state intelligence operatives who organized the shooting and convinced the low-IQ shooter to do it. Watch, he concluded, and then barely a few hours later had to add, at 8 o'clock on 15 March 2019, that was fast, as it came to pass. And there are some other interesting anomalies, too, like Terrence's odd travel history. In the years before the lone gunman allegedly wrote his manifesto and carried out his mission, the Australian citizen claimed to have traveled abroad, visiting the Balkans, Western Europe, Pakistan, Turkey, Iceland, Poland, New Zealand, Argentina, Ukraine, and even North Korea. And let's not forget, New Zealand doesn't even come close to having a Second Amendment, and the Australian immigrant shooter would have found very restrictive laws there. Civilians, say a number of stories, aren't allowed to possess handguns, military-style semi-automatic weapons, or fully automatic weapons without a permit and a firearm license. So yeah, how did this person or persons get all the weapons and ammo, and what's the excuse? More importantly, though, and more to the point, what else is being covered up? Because there's a whole lot of attention being devoted to the 10 years in prison that New Zealand is now threatening for merely possessing the mosque shooting video. But when it comes to censorship, that's just the beginning. Not only are the peons being told that if they knowingly possess a copy of the New Zealand mosque shooting video, they face up to 10 years in prison. If they share it, it's 14 years, and corporations, including web hosts, face an additional $200,000 New Zealand fine under the same law. And as Zero Hedge puts it, copies of Terrence's live stream, along with his lengthy manifesto, began to circulate rapidly on various file hosting sites following the attack, which, as they noted Friday, were quickly scrubbed from the Waystream platforms, including the usual suspects to Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and Scribd. YouTube's gone so far as to intentionally disable search filters so that people can't even find the Christchurch shooting materials, including footage of the suspected multiple shooters, there's the rub, as well as the arrest of Tarrant and the other suspects. Here's the warning from one of the local propaganda outlets, the Wellington Live, noting, New Zealand police would like to remind the public that it is an offense to share an objectionable publication, yada, yada, yada. If you see this video, report it immediately. Do not download it. Do not share it. If you are found to have a copy of the video or to have shared it, you face fines and potential imprisonment. Unquote. You know what, folks? If Big Brother had been able to get away with that here, a whole lot of us would have had a lot more difficulty understanding what really happened at the Pentagon and Twin Towers on 9/11. And the Oklahoma Murrah bombing was before cell phones, so that wasn't yet an issue. The FBI did come in and abscond with all of the video of John Doe's number 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 that you've never even heard about since. And I saw firsthand what happened to all the photographic evidence that General Ben Parton put together the day after that shooting. So it's pretty obvious that Big Brother New Zealand is getting proactive here, just like the FBI did, for example, in Las Vegas. But wait, there's more. Along with the censorship of online materials and investigation of content-sharing platforms such as BitChute and 8chan, where the shooter posted a link to the live stream of his attack, social discussion service Dissenter has been blocked in New Zealand. And that's an alternative to Twitter, created by the people who built Gab AI, and have thus been under attack for quite a while themselves. And that list of banned and threatened alternative websites just keeps growing, from Zero Hedge to Mike Adams Natural News that we'll get to in just a minute. But first, the obvious question, why? Why are Big Brother and its ministries of truth trying to censor video footage of the New Zealand massacre? Maybe the answer is obvious, and certainly more than a few commentators have already weighed in on that aspect. David Knight, for his part, harkens all the way back to the Zapruder film of the JFK assassination. What if they could have made that go away? I guess the good news for Big Brother's murderers and cover-up artists was that there was just that one bit of motion picture evidence to control and explain away. They didn't have to deal with the World Wide Web. Still, the magic bullet did get a bit preposterous after a few decades. Obviously, it's better to just slap a lid on all the evidence right up front. Which brings me to what must be the continuing theme of the week, although it really hits on quite a few fronts. I'm looking at a piece from Mike Adams at Natural News, though, that really summarizes the major threat. Alert, he says, Brideon.com. That's his video platform that's intended as an alternative to Gulag's Big Brother partner YouTube. And it's under extreme threat, he says, from internet infrastructure providers, and has already been forced to delete all New Zealand shooting videos. But wait, folks, there's more. Essentially, at gunpoint, as he puts it, by the globalist controllers of the net. Yep, this is an emergency alert concerning their free speech platform, he begins. I'm writing this at 12:45 a.m. on March 21st. The Brideon platform is now under extreme threat by upstream infrastructure providers over users posting footage of the New Zealand Christchurch shooting. And we're being threatened to remove all the videos or face complete annihilation online, starting with being deplatformed from various infrastructure providers, followed by legal action from none other than the nation of Australia itself. No, not New Zealand, but Australia and its Office of the Safety Commissioner, Ok Tung. Well, says Mike, we anticipated this exact scenario many months ago, which is why we've been feverishly building alternative internal infrastructure to eliminate any dependencies on upstream infrastructure providers. In other words, folks, if you don't own the hardware, the software, and the distribution, Big Brother will throttle you up by the neck. But the trouble is, we're still several months away from completing all of that build-out. So, sadly, over the next few hours, we're being forced, essentially at gunpoint, to delete all videos containing footage of the New Zealand shooting. And by the way, here's where I interject, and that's not all. People like Lisa Haven have been pointing out, if you're trying to find the 73 or 4-page manifesto, that too is being expunged and dumped into the memory hole, just as I've been talking about here, folks, all week long. And I'll connect the dots one more time. If, in fact, it seems more and more likely, this was one more really major false flag intended to do exactly what they've been doing, and not just gun control, but information control, too. Doesn't it make sense that they'd want to make sure nobody is able to actually look at the evidence and point that out to people? Why not just get rid of all the evidence up front? Oh, it's too nasty for you to see, and besides, we don't want you to see what you'd really find. If we allowed you to look, we're not about to. So, voila, they not only get rid of the damning video and the incriminating manifesto, they make darn sure you're not even allowed to talk about it anywhere in the world. Unless, of course, you blame the right people. So back to Mike Adams. If we refuse to take this action, he says, then all of the videos on Brideon will be essentially deplatformed, and none of them will be viewable by the public, meaning the entire website will be annihilated. So make no mistake, we're facing extreme online fascism, censorship, and authoritarian speech police who are exploiting the New Zealand operation to roll out a totalitarian police state across the net. The excuse we're being given is that hosting or sharing the videos is promoting violence, which is an absurd claim on its face, because if videos that depict violence are so harmful to the public, then why did the entire waste stream media play the 9/11 Twin Towers attack a million times over, burning that imagery into the minds of the American people? Well, okay, Mike, asked and answered. And he goes on, but there are many, many, many other examples, folks. As long as you don't play videos like, say, of what really happened at Oklahoma City. And hint, you never have seen those now, have you? Or try to look at the videos from the various casinos that faced the Las Vegas massacre, and especially other shooters that the FBI promptly deep-sixed. And so on. And if this is true, continues Adams, why aren't they banning every Hollywood action movie? What about millions of other violent YouTube videos and so forth? Somehow, he continues, this single New Zealand shooting video, in which, by the way, the rifle brass literally disappears in midair like magical ammo, but hey, you can't confirm or deny that statement now, can you? Yeah, just try looking for it. So here we are. Anyone who dares to examine the actual forensic video evidence, ask intelligent questions about the shooting, or question the official narrative is now being threatened with internet-wide deplatforming and possible legal action. We've now reached the state, he concludes, of total censorship on the net. The beginning of the end of humanity, since no voices, views, or opinions that contradict the official narratives are going to be allowed anywhere online. And maybe it took a false flag like this to set it all up and bring it into play. Which is, come to think of it, kind of what that now verboten manifesto said he wanted to accomplish. Well, I guess you'd have to quote the deep state dupe George Bush there and say, mission accomplished there too. As InfoWars, which has already been essentially deplatformed, has also been talking about, the next escalation of censorship will involve banning URLs from browsers, meaning Google-owned Chrome or Firefox, etc., won't even allow you to type in certain names like Brighteon.com or InfoWars.com or any other site the globalist deep state controllers don't want you to see. Quick aside here, folks, so save the direct IP addresses now. That string of numbers separated by dots, so you can get to the truthful sites at least a while longer. And, continues Adams, they'll probably use another false flag shooting as justification to ban any other URL they want, always, of course, in the same old tired name of public safety. All the while, gun-free killing zones expand right along with the body count. In truth, he says, globalists believe that anyone who can think for themselves is a threat to public safety, which is why they're so intent on making sure they stamp that out of the public cesspools. Oh, and if you're still waiting for the Trump administration to overthrow what he calls these techno-fascist monstrosities, maybe you can expect that right after they lock her up. So on then next to the related stories, starting with New Zealand's own occasional cortex, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, who announced just the first tranche of so-called reforms on their already draconian gun laws, beginning with the immediate ban on the sale of any more semi-auto or so-called assault rifles, whatever that means. And I don't even want you to remember that the accused gunman specifically said he hoped his attack would lead to exactly that. Said their Fuhrer, we are announcing action today on behalf of all New Zealanders to strengthen our gun laws and make our country a safer place, unquote. And why am I hearkening back to an article from the Berlin Daily, April 15, 1935, and a quote from a fellow named Adolf? Here's what he said. Doesn't it sound real similar? Although it's important to remember New Zealand already has full gun registration. Said Adolf, though, for the first time a civilized nation has full gun registration. New Zealand's just following that path. Our streets will be safer, our police more efficient, and the world will follow our lead into the future, unquote. And I guess he had this woman's number. She's doing it. To her credit, I guess you could say in a backhanded way, this lying politician did manage to inject 20% or so truth into her latest set of whoppers. Quote, the effect of this will mean that no one will be able to buy these weapons without a permit to procure them from the police. Now, listen carefully here, folks. I can assure people that there is no point in applying for such a permit because, quote, in short, every semi-automatic weapon used in this terrorist attack on Friday will be banned in this country. And all of us who have watched history play out on this idiotic trend over and over again can also assure everybody listening that it won't make a damned bit of difference other than things will get worse, as they always have, and the body count will continue to skyrocket. As will the censorship and complete shutdown of any coverage of just how bad it's going to get. But for a quick clue, take a look at the warp speed with which New Zealand converted to an Islamic republic, including a burqa-wearing, occasional cortex-imitating, gun-banning airhead of a prime minister. Quick headline next from the Australian Herald Sun to make that point. New Zealand Parliament, it says, opened with an Islamic prayer. I don't have the recording, of course, but it probably went something like this. Praise Allah for helping us to disarm and muzzle the infidels. And we'll be right back, hopefully.
Did you write the book of love, and do you have faith in God above? If the Bible tells you so,
Welcome back now to the second segment of our show for this evening. This is Mark Call, and we interrupt our coverage today of the continued decline and destruction of Western civilization and the rule of law to bring you this brief economic update. I guess it's on the same subject, though, come to think of it. Fed Chair Jerome Powell spoke to the press yesterday after the completion of the FOMC meeting on Mount Olympus, where the almighty Fed revealed its plans. And some, at least, suggest they've still got more splaining to do. I like Zero Hedge's summary and headline. They say Powell threw in the towel on growth and inflation and sees no more rate hikes, despite what we've been saying, in 2019. The executive summary says that in addition to the Fed deciding to leave rates unchanged, they're admitting economic growth has slowed since the fourth quarter, even as they claim the labor market is still strong and job gains are solid. Still, though, they're going to taper their balance sheet roll-off. They see all of that ending by September, and no rate hike is now being forecast this year, maybe only one in 2020. Still, though, the big distraction and discussion is about whether rates are yet neutral or not, based on the R-star and other criteria. Now, those of you that are old enough to remember when we had real economics and real discussions about it, before MMT and socialists and fascists running the show, might remember that, no, it's not called neutral interest rates. What they're really talking about is negative real interest rates. When the interest rate that people get for depositing what they used to call money is higher than the real rate of inflation. Now, the trouble is, they lie about all of that nowadays, especially the real rate of inflation, which is really higher than the median funds rate of 2.4% anyway, meaning real interest rates are already negative, kind of like real growth in the economy, too. So most of what Powell was pushing yesterday was more smoke and mirrors. Expectations, though, are that the FOMC will maintain its more dovish, patient, how's that for a great way to put it, stance and shift from two hikes to one, although zero would likely scare the markets if they admitted that now, in 2019. And the big issue, they say, is whether or not the Fed is now being perceived as dovish enough so that the markets don't panic, in other words, and collapse before they're supposed to. Arguably, a bit closer to the election. And as expected, to justify their relatively newfound dovishness, the Fed has cut its economic outlook. They now see 2.1% GDP growth in 2019, down from 2.3% in December, allegedly, and only 1.9% in 2020. The unemployment rate is projected to rise modestly to 3.8%, and that's, of course, with the usual fudge factors and denominator changes thrown in. By the end of 2020, 2.6% in 2019. Inflation, as long as they keep lying about the real numbers, will remain subdued, even though it's going to go up just a teeny bit. And additionally, as we've already mentioned, the Fed plans to end their so-called balance sheet normalization in September. That's code for stuffing less toxic junk in the way of bonds in their portfolio. Which does kind of beg the question, well then, who else is going to buy it? A follow-up headline after the Fed smoke cleared says, stocks slide, bonds soar, there's a surprise, dollar rebounds, and traders have a question for Jerome Powell. Says Zero Hedge, we said it was too early yesterday to draw conclusions from the S&P's reaction, where a blast of selling took place precisely at 3:30 p.m., setting the dour mood for the last 30 minutes of trading. However, the overnight session, which saw both European stocks struggle and U.S. equity futures slide, despite some bullish sentiment from Asia, well, it still appears that investors have some questions for Powell, among which the most important one was, what does the Fed know today that nobody else does for it to capitulate so abruptly? And what does that mean might be lurking in the shadows? And as is their style, Zero Hedge provided no shortage of analyst commentary and feedback on that score, among which was this observation. What with investors rushing to price in the prospect of U.S. rate cuts later this year, which traditionally have been followed by a recession 3 months later, Treasury yields dived to their lowest since early 2018, and those on German Bunds, the European benchmark, to their lowest since October of 2016. So, alongside widespread curve flattening, where shorter and longer-term borrowing costs converge, there were alarm bells ringing. And here they quote Rabobank strategist Philip Mary, who said that the worry is now, or maybe it has been, that having cut rates to the bone and already tried full-scale money printing, many central banksters are now low on traditional ammunition to fight recession. said, Mary, the Fed has the most leeway because it raised rates 9 times, so it could cut rates 9 times, but it'll be much more difficult for other central banks, which haven't even started to hike yet. And then there's this from Nomura's Charlie McElligott, about which they say, in the aftermath of the Fed's second consecutive dovish capitulation, which while framed as a response to the slowing economy, a slowdown which the Fed completely missed as recently as December, when fully 9 FOMC officials expected 1 or more rate hikes, but now expect 0, and which was really meant to support assets, many have now taken turns to, let's just say, urinate on the grave of Fed credibility. Latest among them, Nomura's Charlie McElligott, who this morning derives some intense pleasure and seems to feel vindicated as, quote, the Fed's hilarious tightening normalization clown car experiment and ensuing credibility farce is now complete. And given, as he makes no shortage of indicating, he's been saying they would do exactly this for quite a while, he gets downright cynical after that. And since his aim has been pretty good so far, here's the rest of the story. On a larger and larger horizon, says Nomura's big guy, the Fed's credibility issue is about the simple fact that for over 10 years now, market participants have already long realized that per the lessons of Japan from 1990 to 2005, the U.S. variety balance sheet recession of 2007-09 would then lead us down the path to this QE trap. And here we are, realizing it in real time. So what does that mean for the future? One, says McElligott, low interest rates are ultimately deflationary, sustaining zombie firms in a liquidity trap, which weigh on overall economic performance while also weakening investment. Folks, this is the essence of real Austrian economics. Number two, low interest rates and QE are deflationary as you incentivize malinvestment and blow perpetual speculative asset bubbles, which ultimately eventually correct and drive deleveraging, thus the so-called balance sheet recession. And number three, as there is still a lot of debt-related scar tissue out there, you can't push credit on a string, which then leads to quick muscle memory returns to a defensive posture, i.e., if there's no return on capital, well, why would you want to deploy any capital? So now he says we see the Fed stuck on this hamster wheel because neither markets nor the economy can apparently withstand a rising interest rate environment. Gee, here we are in the biggest debt bubble in history, so isn't that a surprise? And here's his bottom line. Long-term inflation expectations will never truly be moving higher without full-scale fiscal stimulus. Or, hey, remember helicopter Ben Bernanke? The future state of outright helicopter drops, to which Nomura says, shudder, because debt disruption and demographic forces are just too strong. Unquote, and no wonder Big Brother is so intent on continuing to distract you with anything and everything else, especially things like terrorism and the coming police state. There was a lot more news this week also indicating why it is that the Fed might be deciding, time to back off on the interest rate increases, including a piece from Mark Hansen via Zero Hedge about how U.S. housing has hit a brick wall. Based on a monthly home sales report from Redfin, he says the deceleration for last month, February 2019, year over year, is staggering, especially in high-flying regions. And it looks a lot like what we saw around 2007. When it comes to debt, meltdowns, socialism, and the real economic threats, I guess it's time to go back to Venezuela, where it's not just socialism that the collapse of that particular nation has again revealed to be a major failure, but Bitcoin in particular and blockchain e-currencies in general that are getting some negative PR. Says Zero Hedge, Bitcoin volume collapsed during the latest Venezuelan blackout, as most of the country's 23 states were literally down and out. That widespread rolling blackout in Venezuela that began on March 7 and ended sometime around the 14th resulted in weekly trade volumes on the P2P platform Local Bitcoins, showing that the number of transactions collapsed by as much as 40% in the week ending March 9th. By March the 13th, though, transaction volumes started to form a V-shaped recovery as power was slowly turned back on. And as Francis Coppola, writing for Forbes, has pointed out, 2 days after power was restored, the problem with using Bitcoin during a blackout is it needs electricity. Or really, folks, you might say a functioning internet, which is pretty much the same thing. Nevertheless, Bitcoin adherents rushed to praise their favorite crypto, saying, you know what else didn't work? Debit cards and credit cards, because their network was down too. And of course, even people that wanted paper money, like U.S. dollars, couldn't do it if they needed to get them out of an ATM. A Redditor in Venezuela, notes Zero Hedge, explained how the entire banking sector came to a halt during the blackouts, but some crypto enthusiasts around the country were able to use generators and then tap into local phone lines to then rebroadcast Wi-Fi to a small geographic area, where people could then still transact digital coins on their smartphones. And thus claimed that, well, at least in some places, Bitcoin was running. Says Tyler Durden in Zero Hedge, energy-intensive Bitcoin transactions cannot withstand widespread power outages. And in the case of Venezuela, data showed Zero Hedge readers that transaction volumes crashed when the power went out, but for some who did have access to generators and the internet, it was still business as usual. Perhaps they suggest a future case study will be written on this event. Suggest your hosts, I'd still rather have access to genuine, good old-fashioned, real money, a.k.a. silver coins, in my own hot little hands. Next, a bit of good news today from perhaps an unlikely place. Monsanto, now known as Bayer, and its flagship poison Roundup, a.k.a. glyphosate, has lost again in court. And guess where? Roundup herbicide was ruled to be a significant factor causing a man's cancer, ruled a San Francisco jury on Tuesday. The verdict is the second blow against manufacturer Monsanto, now Bayer, less than a year after the first ever trial that came to the same conclusion back in August of 2018. Says the summary from the Daily Mail, the jury has ruled that Roundup was a substantial factor in causing a man's cancer. A 70-year-old named Edwin Hardin of Santa Rosa, California, who has non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, an immune system cancer, who sprayed thousands of gallons of the weed killer to combat poison oak on his 56-acre property. There will now be a second phase of the trial to decide whether or not the newly renamed company, and you can guess why, knew about the risks and concealed them. And of course, you do have to ask the obvious question. Given what we now know, how the heck could they not have? This next story is perhaps one of the biggest, or at least it should be, in modern post-constitutional history. And it's related to so much that's been going on for quite some time and been covered up so effectively, including the latest testimony, even though it took months to finally come out, in part, from the likes of Lisa Page and Peter Strzok. And here's what should be the banner headline on every newspaper in the entire United States. And it would be, by the way, if it had to do with a Republican or even a rhino. And yeah, I'll admit it, to some extent we knew this all along, but it's still kind of nice to see it finally coming out, even if the waystream continues to ignore it. Bombshell testimony released this week revealed that Hillary Clinton received what amounts to a secret pre-pardon to avoid the possibility that she could be charged under the Espionage Act for her gross negligence in the mishandling and dissemination of classified, top-secret and above government national security material. According to the newly disclosed testimony of former FBI official Lisa Page, the Obama Just Us Department instructed the FBI not to pursue charges against Clinton. Here's what Representative John Ratcliffe tweeted last week about his interaction with the so far unindicted criminal Page. Quote, Lisa Page confirmed to me under oath that the FBI was ordered by the Obama DOJ not to consider charging Hillary Clinton for gross negligence in the handling of classified information. The transcripts reveal the exact question that he asked. You're making it sound, he said, like it was the department that told you you're not going to charge gross negligence because we're the prosecutors and we're telling you we're not going to. To which Page responded, that is correct. Page further said in her testimony that the FBI held, quote, multiple conversations with the Obama Department of Justice about charging Clinton with gross negligence, but the Bureau was told that such a charge would not be brought forward. A little more background here is certainly appropriate, since the waste stream certainly doesn't want to talk about any of this. The Attorney General, sick at the time, was Loretta Lynch Mob, who held that infamous secret tarmac meeting with Bill Clinton just prior to the FBI recommending against charging Hitlery. And in media appearances following the infamous meeting, Lynch, without disclosing her involvement in the case and seemingly already knowing the outcome of the so-called investigation, said she would, quote, accept the recommendations of the FBI. Arguably, we now know, because they'd all accepted somebody else's recommendations going in.
I'm going to make them an offer again with you.
Shortly thereafter, disgraced, fired, but hardly chastened former FBI director, Hormeister himself, James Comey, would hold a press conference just a few months prior to the 2016 election in which he infamously stated that, quote, no reasonable prosecutor would dare bring, I'm sorry, he didn't put the word dare in there, but he should have. No reasonable prosecutor who wanted to live would even think about bringing a case against Clinton. And now we know the rest of the story. An early Comey draft document of the speech accused Clinton of gross negligence, but that's, of course, a term of art implying that there ought to be an indictment, which they weren't about to do. So according to John Solomon of the Hill, that term was changed to extremely careless. We've talked about the chart and all of the people involved in that particular aspect of the cover-up, and that information, too, was a long time coming. Because gross negligence in handling classified information should be a federal crime, and indeed would be if you were a low-level midshipman or somebody on board a submarine or any grunt anywhere in the U.S. military that ought to know better, much less Secretary of State. For her part, Strzok paramour Lisa Page was one of the criminals involved in the sequence of texts that outlined the insurance policy against the potential of the election rigging not coming off as planned and Donald Trump actually being able to sit in the Oval Office. You can bet there was concern that heads might roll unless they managed to do something about it. After which, both Strzok and Page worked on the Robert Mueller Russia witch hunt, which is yet to find any actual evidence of collusion with Russia, well, outside of Camp Hitlery. But Mueller was forced by the embarrassment of having all of this information come out concerning Strzok and Page to unload the dynamic, dastardly duo. And the cover-up's been a continuing battle ever since, while the legacy media, as this story puts it, have been remarkably silent on all the colossal revelations, and it appears that almost no one in the waste stream has bothered to follow up on questions about the latest Page testimony. A verified search, says the Conservative Review, for Clinton Espionage Act on Twitter reveals precisely one legacy media reporter, Aaron Blake of the WAPO, who decided to highlight the remarkable testimony from Page. But no one has asked the key questions about why Obama and his deputies have decided that Hillary Clinton was essentially above the law. More now on the censorship front, and of course the related Islamic caliphate, while we still can. Call it one more dot to connect this evening. Astonishing bias, says a piece from J.D. Hayes at Natural News. There have been 452 Islamic terror attacks in 31 different countries just this year alone so far, with basically zero coverage from the media. So yeah, compare and contrast with the latest New Zealand false flag. Americans, says Hayes, seem to have come to expect such biased coverage from the so-called mainstream media, and more they expect that coverage to be designed to advance the socialist, left-wing, gun-banning, censorship-promoting, totalitarian agenda. After recounting what you already know about the latest New Zealand false flag, from total gun bans to total censorship, he goes through the numbers to prove that by far the bulk of total terrorist attacks this year and in recent years have been committed by Muslim extremists and often against followers of other faiths. But of course, the media, not only in New Zealand, but America, Europe, and everywhere else pretty soon now, generally don't report those, but when they do, the reports are quick, superficial, and only partially fact-based. Certain inconvenient facts are left out. No narratives, though, no outraged guest analysts, and certainly no lecturing, finger-pointing hosts. So yes, the story demonstrates, Muslims have evidently become the deep state's new protected class, and the bottom line runs something like this. In 2019, in total, just so far, there have been a shocking 1,956 people murdered by Islamic terrorists and another 2,019 injured, all of whom combined haven't even gotten a fraction of the coverage of the 50 from New Zealand. much less the totalitarian boot-to-the-face-forever response. So maybe we'll start to wrap up this sequence with more good news and bad news. Starting with the good news, Dutch voters have now sent shockwaves throughout Europe at the polls on Wednesday in the wake of the pretty much underreported but still deadly Utrecht terror shooting in which a now-detained 37-year-old Turkish man went on a terrifying tram-killing spree, leaving 3 dead and 3 injured. Investigators were finally forced to reveal that the migrant may have had a terror motive based on a letter found in the murderer's possession, which led to a, quote, surge of last-minute support for the Euroskeptic Party Forum for Democracy, or FVD in Dutch, which emerged victorious in key provincial elections, paving the way to make it one of the 2 largest groups in the Dutch Senate, and representing the growing Dutch frustration with the recent unprecedented refugee influx and terror upswing in Europe. In a post-election speech, EU critic and party leader Thierry Baudet said, "We're standing in the rubble of what was once the most beautiful civilization in the world. And as a result, an upstart populist party has shocked the Dutch political establishment, basically saying, what we're seeing here is the punishing of the arrogance of the elites." Speaking of which, we'll close with the bad today. Chicago cops have now demanded a probe, and good luck here, by the DOJ into the Jesse Smollett case after meddling by an ex-Obama-era official who called in a favor. From WLS-TV in Zero Hedge, the president of the Chicago Police Union has asked the Just Us Department to investigate allegations that Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox interfered in the police investigation of Empire actor Jesse Smollett after Michelle Obama's former chief of staff, Tina Chen, called in a favor. Fox supposedly recused herself from the case on February 20th, quote, out of an abundance of caution because of her familiarity with potential witnesses in the case. Almost sounds like she got a word from do-nothing Jeff Sessions, too. Well, translation, says Zero Hedge, Michelle Obama's former chief of staff contacted Fox, saying that Smollett's family had concerns about the investigation. And gee, I seem to remember the family of the late Seth Rich having concerns, too. So she tried to get the case transferred from the CPD to, where else? The FBI, where we already all know exactly what would have happened. But good news, she was told to go pound sand. So maybe that's the moral for today, folks. Either a whole lot more corrupt deep state officials start getting told to pound sand real soon now, or all of us may end up pounding something else a whole lot nastier. Now, at this point, we could go in so many different directions, they all fit, but I'm going to go with a bit of good news, courtesy of Tim Brown at the Freedom Outpost, out of the wannabe gun control mecca of Maryland, where more and more people are saying, "We won't comply." Maryland, he begins, needs to rethink its state motto about being a free state, because certainly its so-called representatives and governor don't believe in anything of the sort. But Jeff Holber, founder of Maryland's pro-Second Amendment organization, Patriot Picket, shared in an email the following protest from members. Lots of pictures and whole lots of people wearing T-shirts that say, "We will not comply." They've had demonstrations at the Maryland State Capitol all this past week and have occupied all the seats in day-long hearings on more draconian gun control bills. Holbert even includes a picture of himself with the Wicomico County Sheriff, Michael Lewis, who says he too will not comply with any of the new intended onerous gun laws. Meanwhile, the treasonous gun banners are saying that their "we will not comply" promise is a threat to them. And gee, you blithering idiots, I guess if you threaten people's lives, maybe you should expect something like that in return. Although arguably, nothing they've done has even come close to responding proportionally so far. And they have, of course, been labeled as gun extremists, and no doubt the state will pull out the stops to try to, shut them up, shut them down, and do whatever they need to by any means necessary. Which is why it's a very good idea to announce in advance, "We will not comply with a law which is not a law, but does, in fact, threaten everything we hold dear." Concludes Tim Brown, folks, this is what it's going to take to defeat tyranny. And he's right. I often refer to it with a bit of scriptural advice. Choose this day whom you will serve, because the right choice is getting ever more stark and vital.